Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Each episode, I'm talking to performers from film, television and theatre about one significant role in their career. It might not always be the role they're most famous for, but in each one, I'll be trying to find out about their preparation, the excitement and the sense of nostalgia that goes with any key role in an actor's lifetime. Adam Pearson is a British actor, presenter and campaigner. At the age of 5, he was diagnosed with neurofibromatosis type 1, which causes non-cancerous tumours to grow on nerve tissue. Adam has worked on all 5 series of The Undateables on Channel 4 and presented the BBC 3 documentaries Freak Show and The Ugly Face of Disability, Hate Crime. In 2013, he appeared in the Jonathan Glazer film Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson. And I caught up with him to talk about his role earlier this year. Hi, everybody. My guest this week is Adam Pearson, and we'll be talking about the film Under the Skin. Hi, Adam. How are you?
I am very well, thank you, sir. Absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
No, not at all. How's it been the last year for you in this COVID madness?
Well, lockdown one was great because they went, oh, you can't see other people. And I was like, amazing, other people get right on my nerves. And then the second one was a bit less fun. And at this point, I'm missing my mates. I'm missing the pub. And I haven't had a good hug for a while.
Yeah, I think this one's been just because of the weather as well and just being in winter. And I just think, you know, for most people, it's been a bit crazy. I've found it really tough, really.
But we'll get through it. The rollout's happening and we've got the roadmap. So hopefully the dawn is coming and winter is finishing.
Yeah, let's hope so. Well, listen, I just want to talk, because this is one of my favourite films. I mean, he's one of my favourite filmmakers and stuff. And I've worked with Scarlett a few times. But let's just go back a little bit and just talk me through, when did you get the call? How did you find out about it at all?
Well, I was casting something at the time. I was working for an independent TV company who make a lot of things, Channel 4 and the BBC. And I was casting the second series of The Undateables at the time. This was about 10 years ago now. This all happened. And I got an email from the charity Changing Faces, who are the largest charity in the UK, who support people with disfigurements and visible differences, saying, hey, we've had a film company get in touch. They want a guy with a disfigurement to be in a film. Here's the lady's number. If you're interested, give her a call. And the only, I called, we had a chat, and the only real concrete piece of info I had on anything was the name Jonathan Glazer. And as someone with a business degree, I'd written papers on his adverts. The man's a genius. So there was a little part of me that was like, if you don't at least throw your name in a hat, you're an idiot. And the further down the line the whole process went, the more serious it got.
But what happened at the initial part, though? I mean, had you done any performing before? Had you done any sort of character work or anything like that?
I'd done no character work. I'd done presenting. I'd done documentaries and strand presenting.
Yeah, you've been yourself in stuff, hadn't you?
Yeah, But when you do TV presenting, there is an element of theatricality to it. You're yourself, but with the volume turned up a little bit. And even as a kid, I was always running around the house with, like, the curtain rail around my neck as a cape, going, ah! So I think we all have an innate performer that lays within us. It's a case of do we embrace that? How much of that do we rely on, et cetera, et cetera. So we're all performers, just some of us master it more than others. So I hadn't done any acting or character work up until then. And then I had to send a YouTube clip of myself to see how I moved and how I spoke and posture, body language, cadence, etc. And then I had to go and meet the director. I had to go and meet Jonathan for, like, the final chat. And on the way to that meeting, I got hit by a cab on Tottenham Court Road and broke my leg.
Oh, my God.
And so the first time I met Jonathan Glazer, I was under a taxi in just my pants, surrounded by paramedics, high as a giraffe's arse on morphine, and apparently got the job. That was my first impression.
If only you'd known. If only, that's all it took, was getting knocked over by a cab.
Well, they say break a leg, don't they? And I'm nothing if not a literalist.
So what happened? So you got hit by a cab and then someone told him and he came out to see you?
I called him. Adrenaline kicked in. And I got my phone out. I was just like, hey, funny story. Just been hit by a black cab. Think my leg's broken. I'm still really keen. Don't think I'm not keen. I'm just going to be about 10 minutes late.
That is fantastic. So was he sympathetic or did he still audition you or what happened?
The conversation when him, and again, I've only heard this from other people because, and I can't stress this enough, morphine. He said, bloody hell, Adam, I didn't realise you did your own stunt work. To which I replied, mate, do I look like I've got a fucking stunt double? And,
brilliant.
And then he came and saw me the next day when I was in UCL waiting for surgery. I had to have surgery. I had to have, like, a rod pit in my leg and everything. I went all in on this. Like, when I say broke it, I mean knee and foot not pointing the same way. Levels of broke it. And so he came in, saw me the next day, and essentially offered me the role.
That is amazing. That is one of the best stories of going for an interview I've ever heard.
Everything I could do to not get the role, I did, and they still hired me.
All those things that we feel before we're going for an interview. I mean, when you've done presenting before and stuff like that, but how do you deal with those type of anxieties or nerves, or do you not have them?
Well, I always try really hard. It wasn't the nerves thing that bothered me. I think that's just part of the game at this point. And I'd already been used to cameras and interviews and public speaking and what have you. My biggest thing was, what if I just go in there and fanboy? What if I just go in there, sit down and shout things about Levi jeans and Guinness and Radiohead at a man who has probably had this conversation multiple times with much more articulate people than myself? But you go in and there is an element of they're taking a bit of a punt on you because you're in a film with Scarlett Johansson and no one knows who the hell you are. But you, much like anything, you rock up, you do your job, you hang around people who know a lot more about this than you, and you sit under the learning tree and trust that you're in good hands.
And what did you know about the film, though? Had you read the script? Was there a script? Did you know anything about it? Because it's such an unusual film. It's very atmospheric, and I don't know what it would have looked like on the page, but did you know anything about it?
I knew it was based on a book. At this point, I knew the title, and I knew that there'd be funding coming from Film 4. And I got the book, and I obsessed over the book. And then it turns out the film is nothing like the book. So that was a giant waste of time for I had also deduced in the book that at some point I would need to get my penis out. So I'd kind of reconciled myself to to that very early on in the game that there'd be a nudity scene. And then at some point, I think it was 6 weeks after I broke my leg, I went to Elstree Studios to meet the lady I'd be working with. And I, like I said, I'd done my research. I knew Film 4 were involved. Tyrannosaur had just come out and done exceptionally well. And that was also a Film 4-funded endeavour. So in my head, I sort of managed my expectations and geared myself up to meet Olivia Colman. I was like, I'm going to hobble into that room and Olivia Colman's going to be there. And it's going to be quite cool. And so I walk into this room and go, hi, I'm Adam. And then this woman comes up to me and goes, hi, I'm Scarlett. And at that point, I'd only just seen Iron Man 2. At that point, my inner child starts freaking out. And I play it cool and go, yes, yes, you are.
And how was she? How was that first meeting?
I love Scarlett Johansson so much. She's kind, she's funny, she's smart. She's incredibly charming. She was incredibly patient with me as a new actor who was asking what to her must be really dumb questions.
That's really, I think that is fantastic, though. That idea of there is no dumb questions asking. Because I've worked with Scarlett and she's everything you said she is. She's just wonderful. But that also that thing of being inclusive. She's, you know, that idea of having a discussion, creating a great space to be able to work in. That's really what she's all about. I mean, in that first meeting, what type of things were you discussing? Were you talking about character and story?
Yeah, absolutely. The character, the story, the actual arc is very much put in place. She drives around in that van, coaxing men into it. And it was, oh, would you in real life get into a van if a hot woman pulled up and asked you if you wanted a lift? And I was categorically no, that's how children go missing. And it was, how can we build this character and this dialogue and make it believable? How close can we get it to reality without bastardizing the art form of acting, but also give it a level of depth and gravitas and believability?
But was it on the page? Were you improvising or was it on the page?
So the scene in the van, we have bullet points we have to hit, but we've both got an earpiece in and Jonathan is in the back of the van with hair, makeup, wardrobe. And he's just giving us little bits of direction of what to do and pacing and what have you. But there is a lot of improv in that. The Tesco thing, completely improv.
That's brilliant. That's one of my favourite lines, is the Tesco one.
It's the only gag in the whole film.
It is. It makes it, and you're so relieved for it. But there's something about your character that is—it's pivotal, isn't it, in the film? Because it's where her character finds her humanity. Really, did you talk about the film in those terms?
Yeah, that this is almost the apex of her transformation. So I'm the only one that she lets go.
Yeah.
And how can we hit that process of humanization? Because it happens gradually over the film. Even if you listen to the soundtrack, it starts to get like warmer and warmer and warmer.
Yes.
As the film goes on, which is mostly down to just Mika Levy and just her amazing mind for musicality and the conveying of emotion.
Yeah, the soundtrack, I have to say, is just extraordinary.
Mika Levy is just fucking cracking to work with and be around. I was really fortunate. I got to go and see it with her conducting a live orchestra and doing the entire soundtrack live. And in the film, just in situ, it's amazing. But hearing it done live, it's just a whole other animal.
It sounds like you were very greedy for the whole experience, that you wanted to learn, you were able to ask questions, you were able to be there. And of course, that needs people around you to be receiving those questions and allowing it to happen. So how did you end up going to the recording of the soundtrack, for example?
Oh, I didn't go to the recording of the soundtrack. It was at Breakdown Festival at the South Bank. And one of my good friends, Chelsea, was James Lavelle's curator.
Right.
And he was putting the whole thing on. And so they just asked, did I want to come with them? Her and her husband had gotten a few tickets. And I think they worked out that if they brought one of the guys from the film along, they'd get a little bit of kudos.
Right.
And maybe be able to sneak in to the upstairs party rather than the crappy downstairs one where you have to pay for the booze.
And how did you meet Scarlett, you do a rehearsal, you sort of talk about it. How long between that meet? Is Jonathan at that meeting?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, me, Jonathan and Scarlett had two meetings, one at Elstree and one at a hotel in London, where I learned my favourite fun fact about Scarlett Johansson. Cookies are very much her kryptonite. She loves cookies.
Okay. But also, how long between those meetings to when you shot the film? How long was that between those two?
Not long, because I broke my leg on September 7th, 2011. And then I flew out to Glasgow on the 11th of November, mm-hmm. 2011. So the whole process happened really quickly.
And was that an advantage, not having a lot of time to think about it? I mean, you must have been nervous. I mean, you must have been... Because although you've presented, as we've said, acting is different. I mean, it is. What did you think about the character? What were your thoughts and insights on this man that you were playing?
Well, it was a case of trying to get into that headspace, and again, it was my first one, so I had to have a lot of stuff pulled out of me, and again, that's just complete credit to Jonathan and Scarlett as well to have that kind of time and that patience. Patience with me, and you think about it, but it's also important that you don't overanalyze things and sort of like start to trip yourself out a little bit, because that's like another barrier. If you try and make acting at its heart, it should be like a natural outpouring of the soul, rather than an exercise in memory and mechanics.
Mm-hmm. But when you say they pull things out of you, or they sort of encourage you to think, how did that process go? I mean, what type of notes were they giving? What was the rehearsal process like for you?
There wasn't much rehearsal in a sense. We just got in the van, drove around and had a chat. Mm-hmm. And it's a case of getting in the moment. Before I sort of started acting, I used to watch interviews with actors who would say things like, get lost in the moment. And as a non-actor, it's really easy to look at actors saying that kind of thing and just go, you wanker. But I completely get it now. Like, completely get what they mean.
Mm-hmm. But you had great understanding for the character. I mean, there's a bit where you talk about needing to shop at night and stuff like that. I mean, did you bring any of your own experience to the role?
I think any actor brings their own baggage to the role. It's why most actors are in therapy. We're dark, needy people who spend our lives pretending to be someone we're not, because the reality of who we are is complex and awkward. And there are elements of certainly growing up and feeling ostracised and not wanting to go to certain places, and that desire to, I suppose, be invisible, unnoticed, and live a quiet life free of ridicule. Mm-hmm. And so those are emotions that whilst I didn't have then and don't have now, I certainly have experience of and have very much had to process. Mm. And I suppose the tricky part was letting one's guard down enough to go back to those emotions and relive them again, rather than being matter of fact. And even in interviews, she said that I'm at heart an advocate. And so to go back and experience the thing that you advocate against was somewhat challenging. But again, because of good direction and a very kind, patient co-star who has just this amazing emotional intelligence, you get there.
Can you just talk to me about that challenge, though, revisiting those emotions? You say they're challenging. Are they challenging because you've buried them so deeply, or are they challenging because they're upsetting?
I think it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. I think to say I buried them is grandiose. I think you've dealt with them, you've reconciled with them, and therefore you don't think about them, not because you don't want to, but because you don't have to. Mm-hmm. And I think you can still acknowledge your past pains and traumas and experiences without overly dwelling on them. Mm-hmm. And so to go back and process them, have to kind of process them again for the purpose of this character, was tricky because I haven't had to do it more out of necessity. I haven't had the need to do it rather than a lack of desire to do it.
I mean, sometimes when I access stuff from my own life in my work, you know, sometimes I can access it surprisingly easy. But what I can't do easily is let it go at the end of the day or the end of the shoot or something. It's like I've opened up a bit of a well in there as well. I mean, did you have any of that?
Oh, absolutely. There are times when you've got to, even everyone on a film set has to experience the same thing together. And I think when they yell cut, the idea that you can just clap your hands and be right, pub, is a ridiculous one. I remember after the night after they shot the baby on the beach, I was downstairs with sort of like Jeremy and the camera guys, and everyone was just still, even like a day removed, still super messed up.
Oh, I am. I mean, I'm messed up having seen it. I mean, God, what it must have been like to shoot it. I mean, gosh.
And that's what they were talking about. And they were just talking about it, going, yeah, that was weird. That was dark.
That's so
and,
strange.
And then we just, and then, you know, and we just, they just had a pint and had a chat about it. And I suppose that's how you process it. I don't think you can park that and leave it where it is.
No, and
Hi, honey, how was your day? We made a baby cry on a stormy beach at midnight. Wednesday!
No, that's just weird. The scene in the van is beautifully played. It's something it's both surprising and tender and really sort of wonderful, I think, given the two of you in the van. But then you get to the house and that's quite a tricky scene for different reasons, isn't it? How did you prepare for that? Just talk us through what happened in that scene and how you prepared for it.
Yeah, so the house stuff is scripted. The house stuff, I've got, at this point, I've got not many lines granted, but I got bullets and points that I have to hit. And again, it's all about making sure you know what you have to say and move how you have to, but without making it that exercise in mechanics and memory that I spoke about earlier. And also, it was like a closed set and there's nudity involved, so I also wanted to keep things like completely and utterly respectful. Mm-hmm. But by this point, I'd grown to really like Scarlett Johansson as a person. And I didn't want to be... And she gets enough weirdos more than likely anyway without me sort of adding to it. And I at the time, we also had a girlfriend who I didn't want to disrespect either. And so it's a case of keeping all that in mind, doing your job, being respectful, and also giving it your all. Mm-hmm. I think very often it's easy to forget that as actors, we're there to do a job. This isn't shits and giggles.
No. But also, talk me through the set. The set is a very strange place, isn't it? How was that? Is it in a studio, I presume?
Well, it's divided into two things. So the building and going up those stairs is in Glasgow. Mm-hmm. And then what is often called the dark void in the Reddit sphere, when discussing this song, is in studio. And it's a black marble floor. And in the corner, you've got like a tank of almost tar/molasses. Mm. And just below the surface is a hydraulic grate. And the way they make it look like you're sinking into the floor is just really clever lighting and camera work. And the guys are walking forward while the grate's being lowered. And we've got diving weights around our ankles as well, because the stuff is that thick that it has a lot of buoyancy to it. It can support a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm only, what, 9 stone 9?
So how did it feel walking into it? I mean, it looks like treacle.
Yeah, it's cold. It's quite thick. So you've really got to push when you're walking in it. You're really got to kind of put your back and your ass into it to make it look like you're walking forward organically. And we did 3 different takes. So we did one of me walking forward just up to here.
Up to your neck, then
Then we did me walking forward, not being lowered, up to here. And then we did one of me going right under.
Yeah, now how was that? Because there's 3 guys, I think, who have to go right under. I mean, did you have any worries about going right, putting your head through it?
No, not at all. Not at all. I knew the guys that did all the set and stuff, and to this day I still love and trust Jonathan Glazer implicitly. And so you go right. He says, because I've spoken about it, he says I was under for maybe 3 seconds and it felt like a minute to him. And as soon as I go under, all I can hear is just shouting, "Get him up!"
Was the safety guys, they're like, because I've worked in water tanks where there's always safety divers and stuff like that. Are there people around like that?
Yeah. There are people around to, should something go wrong, every circumstance is mitigated for. So at that point, I was like, okay, I don't need to worry about this. I'm gonna knock this one out of the ballpark, because the stuff takes ages to get off.
Yeah, I was so gonna say.
If anything, I wanted to get it right the first time, so I don't have to fuck about with this again. Like,
did they have to hose you down?
Yeah. To get in like a giant bucket hose and then go and shower off. And there's like, you put a layer of barrier cream on beforehand, so it doesn't truly stick to you. Getting it off was an endeavor.
And did you know, are you an actor who like watches yourself on the monitor? Do you know, can you see what it looks like? Are you looking at it in playback or anything like that?
I don't like seeing anything until it's done. The first time I want to see myself is when everyone else sees it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why is that, do you think?
I want my opinion of my performance to be unbiased and unclouded at this point.
Mm-hmm. And that's to do with the fact that you're trusting your director implicitly.
Yeah, absolutely. And also I don't want my own bias to affect the role. Again, I don't want to overanalyze it and overthink it and almost start doing a director's job for them.
Mm-hmm.
I want to respect that power dynamic that exists.
But are you able to, the instincts that you have for the character, the experience that you have from your own life that you're bringing to the character, is that something that you will sit down and discuss with the director? Is it something you think, I'm just going to play this, and if it's wrong, he'll tell me?
A 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other, I think. Mm-hmm. I think you have a really brief chat with the director, but you don't overcomplicate it or restrict it too much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can, because otherwise it all becomes a bit boxed in and it looks forced. So I think you have vague direction and bullet points, and then you nail it. And then if they have feedback, you take it, you listen to it, you process it, and you do it.
Okay.
I think any good actor should be able to take direction and criticism exceptionally well.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I think sometimes we are victims of our insecurities, though, aren't we? That we, because acting is exposing, we are stepping forward, we are asking people to judge us, all those things, that we can get quite insecure. Have you ever, is there a way that you have of like working through it, any insecurities, or have you not encountered that?
Well, there is an element of when you have to do multiple takes of things, particularly with Under the Skin, because it was my first acting gig. When you have to do something for like a 9th time, there is that little voice of doubt in your head that goes, I must really be effing this up. Like, I must well and truly be messing this up. But then you learn it's just they're getting different angles and stuff, and that they're getting options. And I think being able to silence that voice is really important. But also knowing that if you are messing up, you will be told in no uncertain terms.
Right. And how, in the van, how does he film it? Is it sort of little cameras everywhere on the dashboard and on the windscreen and stuff? And you say he's in the back of the van. So is he sort of, has he got monitors in the back of the van as you're driving along?
Yes, so to the best of my knowledge, there were monitors in the back of the van, and there were, I think, 8 purpose-built cameras in the cab to get the interior and the exterior. By the end of the shoot, we had roughly 120 hours of surveillance-style footage, of just stuff, of just people.
Wow. I mean, when she's just driving along and she's just asking for directions, I mean, that's pretty extraordinary. I mean, I guess that's the hidden camera stuff.
And it really draws you in. Mm. I often say to people, if you like this film and you want a super weird experience, watch it. And then just put your headphones in, play the soundtrack, and just go out and watch people.
Oh, God, I've got to do that.
Just sit in a coffee shop when you can and watch people.
I do that anyway. That's my life.
We'll be back with more chat after this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, you're listening to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Now, back to this week's episode.
And what was it like when, you know, you finished the filming, and what did you walk away from that experience with? What did you, because you say it was your first acting role. Mm-hmm. Did it whet your appetite to sort of do more character work?
Absolutely. I think when you do something like that, I think to just completely walk away from it and be like, well, that was fun, back to my real life, would be rather disingenuous. And the biggest thing that I had when I walked away from it was thinking, I hope this isn't shit. How is this going to be received is always the big worry. And then it did really well, and it stuck around. And I genuinely thought it would be in cinemas for 2 weeks, and I'd never see or hear from it again.
So did you have a premiere?
I went to the London premiere. Yes, I couldn't go to things like Telluride or TIFF or Venice, but I very much got to go to the London premiere. I took my best friend, Anna.
Was that the first time you saw it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the first time you saw it was with an audience at the premiere?
Indeed.
And what was that experience like?
Really, really cool. I think there's something, because it's a certain type of person that goes to a premiere. When you go to a premiere, you're there with people that either love film or loathe film. They're there to build or they're to destroy. No one is there with the mindset, I'm just going to check this out. And so to get that kind of ambiance and that feeling and just see, and I like reading. I'm a real cold reader. So I'm looking around, looking at kind of people's body language and just hearing just the silence in the room at certain moments. Like, again, we've mentioned it, Baby on the Beach, when she murked a surfer with a rock, just people, you can hear people's either, you can either hear a sharp intake of breath or an A in a snapping shot. Those are the two correct reactions to that scene. And just to just watch people get just sucked into this and just how engaged people are in a film where there's no spoken dialogue for a good 20 minutes at a time.
Mm. But are you able to look at your own performance objectively at that point? I mean, watching it in a premiere with lots of people, you know, it's being reviewed, you know, I mean, are you able to look at yourself and think, oh, that was a good job there. I wish I'd done that a bit differently or whatever. Can you be critical and objective about it?
At the time, no, because I didn't know what I was looking for. But now I can look back and think, yeah, that was good. Or, oh, I understand why I was directed to do that. But I don't think anyone can be truly objective about their own performance anyway. I think there's an element of bravado that exists to all actors where they'll be like, yeah, I nailed that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also sometimes it depends who we're watching it with. Sometimes if I'm on my own, I can watch something and think, okay, I'm watching this and I can see where I might have wanted to do something different or where something has worked or whatever. When I'm watching it with an audience, I have a different experience and just as valuable about seeing where things land and don't land. But yeah, you're right. I mean, mostly you can never be totally objective about it. And how did it change your life? It must have changed your life as far as being an actor was concerned.
I am attached to what is widely regarded as one of the best films of the decade. And when I told you I thought it'd be in cinemas for a couple of weeks and it'd then leave my life, I could not have been more wrong, could I?
No.
I could not have made a worse... If I wanted a quiet life, then Under the Skin was a bad decision. As far as that goes. I still talk about it today. I still have people come up to me at underground stations and talk to me about it today. One of my best friends Anna's favourite places to get coffee is at the cafe in the VFI on the South Bank. I can't go there without having a conversation with someone.
Yeah.
I'm like, can we just go somewhere else? Can we go to like a Nero in Lambeth where no one's gonna want to talk to me about Under the Skin?
It's an endlessly, as I said, it's one of my favourite films, so it's an endlessly fascinating film as well. It keeps giving and giving. There's things every time you see it that you see it differently and experience it differently. And watching it again for this podcast, you know, there is a real sorrow and tenderness in your performance. And having seen you on other programmes where you're yourself and you're presenting, you know, there's a confidence, there's a humour, there's a real connection with the audience that you're giving that's, you know, out there. But on that, there's a real sense that you're unconfident as a character, that when you get into that van, you're taking such a risk in a way. And I love what you bring to the character in that way.
And the reason I like, and thank you first and foremost, and the reason I like hearing people like yourself say that who understand film is it puts into focus what acting is. Because very often, particularly at the moment, we're having the debate rages on about disability in film and quipping up and how far is too far and what acting is. And when I had this debate with the Sia movie, and this idea that if you have a disabled character, a disabled actor playing a disabled character, that it somehow isn't acting, is ludicrous. It makes absolutely no sense to me. It is a female playing a female character not acting then, or a BAME actor playing a BAME character, and I certainly agree that there is an element of facade to acting. But I think we need to be really careful when we talk about things like protected characteristics. And often people don't really understand the debate that certainly the disabled acting community is trying to have when it comes to representation.
So what would you like to see? What would you like to see more happening in that arena?
I want to get more disabled actors in the audition room. That's what I want, and let their talent do the talking. But at the moment, we're not even getting that.
Right.
As someone that has spent a lot of time in Leicester Square at Spotlight, it's one of the most inaccessible buildings in London. So if you can't get disabled actors literally through the door, how are you ever going to get them on screen? And there's also laziness. Spotlight redid their website, and they had a disability opt-out box for casting directors. I mean, what's that? I mean, they quickly removed it when they got called out on it and threw equity under the bus a little bit. But, you know, what's that all about? And it's just a case of changing people's attitudes and letting disabled actors use their talents and do the talking. And you know, organically, we'll get there. In 1965, Olivier won an Oscar for playing Othello. Are we going to do that in 2021? Mm. No, we aren't. Shakespeare plays used to be all male casts. I believe a theatre company in New Zealand tried to do that in 2017 and rightfully got shot down. So progress does happen. I just think disability is very much not at the table when it comes to the diversity and inclusivity conversation in the wider media industry. And
but
absolutely.
When you bring up the Olivier example, would you put Daniel Day-Lewis in that as well for My Left Foot?
I would. People often use that as an example. Or De Niro's Descent of a Woman, or Rain Man from 1988. And I think art needs to be looked at through the prism of time in which it was created. And at the time, all those, amazing. So things have moved on. We have a better understanding of both disability and diversity, and the landscape's very different now. Mm-hmm. And I think when we say things like, oh, what about Olivier, what about My Left Foot, what about Rain Man, I think we need to be like, yeah, great, but let's all move on. Mm-hmm. and represent that community better than maybe we have done Before, from a production point of view.
Do you see examples? Where are the examples that it is working? I mean, sometimes I'm looking at I've always felt that our soap operas are very, you know, really out there, and they sort of kick down the barriers, and it seems to be working there. Do you think that's true?
I think soap operas are doing a very good job. There's actual disabled actors playing actual disabled roles there. I just think film is so far behind because it's a money game. And the decision makers just don't get it. They attach a name, a number to a name, and that's how you get funding. Mm-hmm. And the argument that there are no disabled actors who can bring in that audience, right, number one, whose fault's that? That puts the cart very much before the horse, in my opinion. But also, if you need to attach a name to a film rather than letting the actual film and the story stand on its own merits, maybe you're making bad films.
Mm-hmm. And you think that the movie industry, is there any examples where you've seen that working in recent years?
I can't think of anything that got a wide reach. Mm-hmm. The last disabled actor to win an Oscar for playing a disabled role was in 1987. There have only been two out of the, I think, 27 Oscar awards for disability. Only two have been disabled. Mm-hmm. And that befuddles me completely. Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, the change needs to happen not just in front of the camera with the stories and the actors that we're seeing, but in all crew members, I think. But what about things like cinematography and, you know, all the other jobs that are on a film set? I mean, there seems to me that's the other areas we need to be looking at.
Absolutely. If you don't get it right off-screen, you're never going to get it right off-screen. And there's this idea that disability and inability are very much the same thing, when nothing could be further from the truth. Mm-hmm. And there's all these lazy excuses about, oh, we can't get a wheelchair up a hill. well, you can get 10 tons of camera gear off a hill. So mm-hmm. explain that one to me. Thank you, please.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to be held to account. And at the moment, that isn't happening because there are no disabled voices in positions of authority anywhere.
And you talk about equity and places like that. I mean, are there, from your point of view, is there any movement for change at those top echelons of representation?
Equity have a very good deaf and disabled members committee who very much feed into the industry and hold people to account. So the conversation is happening. But as I alluded to before, I don't think everyone's having the same conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of pandering and glad-handed yes men at the top of the industry who make a lot of very good noise, say a lot of things, and will put in targets and quotas that they inevitably don't meet, but very little actual action. Like at the BBC, for example, on-screen disability went down last year,
mm-hmm.
despite all of the talking. And I think we need to start holding people to account. And when they don't do what they say they're going to do, they maybe need to either pay a fine or find a new job.
Mm-hmm. And who, I mean, you know, it's that thing of when you say keeping them to account, it's all our jobs to keep them to account, isn't it? It's not just you and the your you know, community, I guess. But I mean, it's everybody, isn't it?
Oh, it is. I always say it's not the job of the disabled acting community to fix a problem they didn't create.
Mm-hmm. And does it start with writing or does it start with the commissioners?
I think both. I think we need to empower disabled writers to tell disabled stories. And then when they do, commission them. Like, I don't, when people say, oh, but that's a risk. Everything's a risk. You know, crossing Tottenham Court Road to go to a film audition is a risk. So stop using that as an excuse just because you maybe have some kind of unconscious bias or what have you. And often we forget that the economical output of risk is reward.
Mm-hmm. And I've always thought that we have to reflect the world we see. And if we're not, you know, if it's not up there. One of the things for me is when I was growing up was I was inspired by people I saw on screen who reminded me of me or the world I inhabited. So if you're not seeing it, then you don't think it's possible.
No, when I was a child, I didn't think disabled people were allowed on TV because there weren't any. And if you were an alien and your only knowledge of disability was portrayal in films, you'd all assume that we lived in layers under volcanoes in the Bahamas and just didn't like secret agents.
And what about acting roles for you in the future? I mean, what have you got lined up? What is your plans?
I tend to take things on a case-by-case basis and just see what the offer is, see who it's coming from, see what they have. I don't want to do anything that's going to perpetuate the problems.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to... So if anything comes in and it's sort of like either a wanky victim role or a because disabled villain role, I have no interest in that. Go away, write a better character and then come back to me. Don't use disability as some kind of shorthand because you're too lazy to flesh out a character.
And how often do you read that type of character? How often do you get scripts that have that?
A couple of times a year. I get just like an awful disabled villain because disabled.
Mm. I mean, it has been used that in the past, hasn't it? This idea of disability equaling evil in some way.
It's everywhere. Disney, mm. Scar from the Lion King, Captain Hook, Alex Trevelyan in GoldenEye, who his disability makes him evil. Beforehand, great guy. Acquires a disfigurement, becomes an arsehole. What's all that? What's all that about?
Yeah, it is an old lazy trope, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Or this idea of victimhood in the film Wonder, a kid gets a medal for having a disfigurement and not killing himself. Like, oh, okay, where's my damn medal? And yeah, it's just a very one-dimensional view of looking at disability. And where's the incidental disabled characters? Where's the character that has a disability, but no one mentions it?
Yes. I think that's the big change, isn't it? Where you're playing a character that it's got nothing at all to do with the disability. It's just a proper character. It's a character in the story.
Absolutely, and that's what we need to get better at. And that's and when I say go away and write a better character, that's exactly what I'm referring to.
Are we getting better in society at all?
I think we are. I think we are. I think it's slow, but I think we are getting there. And I sometimes feel sorry for people in these conversations, because we've got this landscape now that's so politically correct that everyone's afraid to say the wrong thing for fear of being cancelled or kind of cancelled, that people just sit in awkward silence. So until we can do away with cancel culture and let people maybe inadvertently say the wrong thing and be lovingly corrected, We aren't going to go anywhere. But I hate cancel culture. I'd rather have a good, honest conversation and maybe be a bit offended, but also be able to, you know, I'm a big boy, I can handle it, but be able to lovingly correct someone. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge difference between outright bigotry and just uncertainty and maybe getting it wrong. And I think when we treat those things as the same, we stop what could be a fruitful conversation.
I think that's great to hear. I mean, absolutely, because there is, particularly in Britain, we survive on embarrassment, and terrible, terrible things happen because we're too embarrassed to talk about it. And, you know, and in all walks of life and in all areas of life. So I think being able to have the conversation, no matter how awkward and difficult it is, it has to be had.
Yeah, nothing worth doing ever happened easily, ever. If it was easy, we'd all do it.
And in your, I had to say that your documentary I thought was amazing, Freak Show documentary that you did, where you go to America and you do stand up at the end, which I thought was great. Are you doing any more of that?
I'm trying to. Obviously, comedy clubs aren't open.
No, at the moment.
Open mic slots are rather scarce. That whole documentary came about because of Under the Skin. When it came out in America, I got a message on Facebook from a man called Todd Ray, who at the time owned and ran the Venice Beach Freak Show in California, essentially saying, if you're ever in California, you let me know. There's plenty of work out here for you. And at the time, I was a little bit kind of, fuck you, motherfucker. And then I told my friend Dan about it, who worked in development at the TV company I was working for. And he's like, that's hilarious. We should make a documentary about it.
But it's a wonderful documentary. I mean, I think it's really, you know, the bit where you meet, is it Matt Fraser? Who's performing, and just, you're sitting in a bar, and these two girls coming and have a photograph with him, and they know him, they've seen his show. There's something in that you think, wow, okay, it's a real empowerment that's happening for him and other people.
No, completely. And I love and adore Matt Fraser. He's all about empowering disabled voices to tell their own stories. And even through just hanging around the guy, I've learned so much via osmosis, and he's going to hear this and he's going to get well cocky. But I love and adore Matt Fraser. He's a solid, solid guy.
Yeah, and his act is quite out there, isn't it?
Oh, are you sitting comfortably? Not anymore.
That's brilliant. Adam, it's been so great talking to you. I can't tell you what, I mean, as I said about Under the Skin, it's such a wonderful film, but it's a brilliant performance. And, you know, you bring so much tenderness and real sort of heart to the film. It is the pivotal part of the film for me. And when, you know, there's a bit that we didn't talk about where you're running through this waste ground and it's like this liberation, and it's so fantastic to see. It's a really brilliant piece.
That was so cold. That was like at 4 a.m. in November. I had to run down that hill 8 times, and I think that they got it on the first take, and the rest of it were just paying me back for breaking my leg and missing my flight and stuff.
Yeah, I always think that. I did something at a tank recently where I had to dive into this water and stay under the water for ages. And afterwards, I kept thinking, I must have pissed this director off somewhere. I don't know why, because they made me do it so many times. It was horrible. Great. It's been wonderful to talk to you. And thank you for your insights into what we need to do in our profession. Great stuff, mate.
Who Am I This Time? Is a Just Voices and Doolally production. Produced by Simon Lennigan. Music by Greg Hatlow. Edited and mixed by Russ Keffert at Audio Egg, and presented by me, David Morrissey.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.